The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, Episode 20.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the podcast. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian Podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. A few items before we get started. Head over to my podcasts page, culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts. Join the Culinary Libertarian Facebook page by clicking on the Facebook icon. Also, do please consider becoming a patron at my Patreon button, also on the podcasts page. Anything you wish to contribute is very much appreciated. Also, find, like, and rate the show on your favorite podcatcher. The more reviews of the Culinary Libertarian Podcast we get, the more ratings we get, the higher the show goes in the rankings, and that gets more people listening. The more people listening are the more people cooking. Election 2020 is over a year away, but already the crazies are coming out. Bite back. Against all the misinformation you're going to hear with my affiliate link to Liberty Classroom, culinarylibertarian.com/biteback. Find over 20 courses on history, politics, logic, and the new American Economic History Part 1, culinarylibertarian.com/biteback. All right, folks, today is a All By My Onesie episode, and this is a listener-requested episode about mother sauces. In the lexicon of classical French cooking, there are five hot mother sauces, and that's what we're going to talk about today. With this released observation, good cooking is always appreciated, but I think it's worth noting that home cooking, and even excellent home cooking, need not attempt to replicate restaurant cooking. There's just such an advantage in a restaurant for ingredient and equipment and space, and it's just, it is an unrealistic expectation to put on yourself to think that you're going to be able to reproduce exactly what you had for dinner at your favorite place. Now, if you do, well, that's just amazing and good for you, but you allow yourself a little flexibility here. So let's just start with the five mother sauces are hollandaise, bechamel, velouté, tomato, and espagnol. From those five, they're called the mother sauces because from them you get the children, which they don't call children. They call the derivatives small sauces. So from hollandaise, the most popular small sauce is béarnaise. Bechamel, hard to know what the most popular one is. Soubise, mornay, a mushroom, velouté. You can get also soups, by the way, from bechamel and from velouté. Tomato is fairly obvious, although an interesting observation for the classical French version of tomato sauce is it has pork bones in it. Now, pork bones is a lot to ask into a tomato sauce. It takes a long time to do, and there's plenty of people who would prefer not that. There is, in modern cooking and certainly at home, there's no reason that you can't substitute a really spectacular homemade marinara sauce for the tomato sauce and still get really great results. The last mother sauce is a mouthful to say, and it's the Mac Daddy of sauces as far as technique goes, and that's Espagnol or the brown sauce. From the brown sauce, we get maybe the most famous, well-known small sauce, which is called demi-glaze, but you can also get sauce Perigot, sauce Robert, sauce Bordelaise, like, you know, from the Bugs Bunny cartoons. Let's just make also one observation that these mother sauces are for the hot side. Whereas we would have the cold side in the kitchen, we have the hot side and the cold side. The cold side has its own kinds of sauces. We've got vinaigrettes and sauce mayonnaise, and there are a few other things, well, mostly mayonnaise-based sauces. But the mother sauces really were referring to a wide variety and mostly all of the sauces on the hot side. Now, there are a few called the beurre blanc, the butter sauce, which in the egghead circles of cooks, there's an argument about whether or not it is actually a funky version of a bechamel or a cream sauce. Well, it's sort of fun, but not really to argue, but that's another story. There's also reductions and gastriques. There are other kinds of hot sauces that are outside of the scope of what we're talking about today. So to make our sauce, obviously the milk, we didn't really do very much for that. We opened the container. But for our velouté, which is a thickened stock, I have a brief explanation and discussion about stocks on culinarylibertarian.com/8, which was the soups episode. There's a little discussion about making stocks, but making stock basically is the liquid obtained by cooking bones and or flesh and vegetable and aromatics, bay leaf, thyme, parsley stems. Some people would put garlic or clove, maybe. It's a powerful flavor, into their stock also. And part of those decisions about what to put in can be made by knowing what's going to be the final result. So this stock, bones and cold water, are brought to a boil and then turned down to a simmer. So try to go over the stocks kind of quickly. So chicken bones or veal bones, fish bones, we can get a white stock from them. Now, white meaning that it is free of brown color. So let's say we've got veal bones, we can roast them in the oven. And in the course of roasting them for a couple of hours, possibly, what we develop on them is just like a piece of roast that comes out of the oven. It's got a nice deep brown color to it. That deep brown color is two things for the stock. It's obviously the color, but it's also that deep, rich, beefy, veal-y flavor. You can roast chicken bones to make a roast chicken stock, which really is pretty stinking good. It also makes a really good soup. Roasting fish bones, I've never tried it. I've never even been interested in trying it. I suppose it's possible, but I'm struggling to figure out why. So cold water. Cold is important because we want the flavor to slowly sneak out of the bones and sometimes even flesh, meat, into the water. Bring that to the boil. If you watch cooking shows, you're going to see a lot of variety and a lot of different opinion. And so in my opinion, the proper process for cooking a stock is take the thing that takes the longest to cook, the bones, and let them cook by themselves in the water for 3/4 or longer of the prescribed time. Now, fish bones, being very thin and small, will break down pretty quickly. So I would not cook a fish stock longer than really 45 minutes, but probably 30 minutes. A chicken stock, probably not more than 3 hours. And a veal stock, probably up to 8. If you put vegetables in veal stock at the very beginning, by the end of those 8 hours, the vegetables have just completely disintegrated and they end up making the stock a little cloudy, but they also give it a muddied flavor, which is not what we want to have from a stock. If a stock is not superior once we've made it, the sauce we make from it or the soup we make from it has no chance of being excellent because we started with mediocre. That's a basic of cooking. You want great? Start with great. I would add the vegetables to any of these things, including the fish, in the last 15 to 20 minutes, possibly half an hour in the specific case of the roasted veal stock. I would also, in a separate pan or at a different time, roast all the veg. You can either roast them in the oven, coat them a little bit of oil, or do them in a saute pan to get them to get caramel, to get color. That color turns into deeper color in the stock because the caramel is water soluble, so it's going off into the color, into the water, but also it's giving us a rich flavor, which turns out not sweet. Chicken, add the veggies at the last. So what are the veggies? Well, the veggies, the French have lots of terms for these things, and at culinarylibertarian.com/20, the show notes page for today's episode, I'm going to have a link for some of the vocabulary in French cooking. So the word we're talking about now, the phrase we're talking about now is mirepoix. Mirepoix is, at its minimum, a mixture of onions, celery, and carrots. So if you're doing it by cups, you have 2 cups of onions, a cup of celery, a cup of carrots. And that's mostly because the onions, once they cook, they release a lot of their acridness and they offer a nice, not sugary sweet, but they offer a nice depth of sweetness, which complements everything else. I fancy adding a few other things to my mirepoix as well, depending on the thing, but generally fennel sticks, the top of the bulb, also parsnips. I'm a big, big fan of parsnips. Leek greens can be used in a beef stock. I would not use them in a chicken stock necessarily, but maybe, but certainly some leek goes in there. Anything that has a good flavor of its own is fine. So what would we exclude? We would exclude Brussels sprouts. I would exclude asparagus. I would exclude cabbage. These are not things to me that are appropriate for the base for a flavor for a stock. Once the veggies are in, roasted or not, let them cook for half an hour or so. And then the last thing that's going to go in is either it's called a sachet or a bouquet garni, but it's the last little bit of additional depth of flavor. So black peppercorns, parsley stems, bay leaves, possibly a clove of garlic, possibly a clove. Another cooking for 5 to 15 minutes, and then strain the stock. At this point, all of the stuff that's in the pan, the bones, the meat, the veg, that's discarded. There's nothing to be obtained from that. And then you have your stock. Now, one of the important parts of making the stock is once you bring the water to a boil, cut it down to a simmer, and simmer is somewhere between 180 and 200 degrees at sea level, but more to what we want to see in the pot is a very kind of a slow convection. We want to see the water moving just a little bit, and as long as the water is moving a little bit, not a rapid boil, then we have what we want inside is the convection to help sort of get all of the bits to the top. As you bring your stock to a boil and reduce it to the simmer, what's going to happen is in the first 20 minutes or so, you're going to get a lot of foamy stuff on top. Depending on how much stock you're making, it can sort of be alarming. It looks kind of like Lake Erie in 1972. Lots of foam. Well, that foam, it certainly isn't attractive. It doesn't necessarily taste bad. Well, yeah, it does. We want to get rid of it. So the phrase in the business is skim the scum. Use a kitchen spoon or use a ladle and just carefully put the lip of the utensil just above the surface of the liquid and lift as much of that scum off as you can. It contributes nothing whatsoever to your stock. It's just trash, so get rid of it. If you miss a few bits, well, that's not the end of the world. If we left all of it in there, what's going to happen is it will end up settling back in the stock, and that will make the stock a little bit cloudy, which isn't ideal for a sauce or a soup, but also it gives it kind of just a little bleh flavor. And we don't want bleh, we want wow. So cold water, bones, boil, simmer, let that go for the required amount of time, half an hour or so before the end of that. We're adding the veg, 15 minutes. We're adding the sachet or the mirepoix, or the bouquet garni. Now, no salt, no salt, no salt. You don't want to add salt because you don't really know what's going to end up happening to your stock. And if you end up reducing it a lot, cooking it so that the water comes out and what's left behind is the flavor. If you do that, the other thing that's left behind is the salt. And despite what all of the urban myths tell you, there is no way to remove saltiness from a thing. There's nothing you can add. There's nothing you can do. Harry Potter can't fix this. Don't add salt to your stock. All right, stock's done. Stock's cool. Now what do we do? So now let's talk a little bit about making these sauces. So Auguste Escoffier was the fellow who codified all of the French sauce making. Next to pastry, probably the single best contribution to the legacy of cuisine the French gave us was the sauce. Lots of people can cook, but the French perfected the sauce. The velouté, the béchamel, are going to be sauces that are thickened with a thickening agent called a roux, R-O-U-X. Also, the brown stock, the veal stock, is going to be thickened with a brown roux, but it's the only thing different is that we've cooked it to make it brown. So let's take a minute to talk about thickening agent, the roux. So the roux is a mixture, a combination, cooked on the stove. It's made by cooking a ratio of flour and clarified butter. We could also use, we could use pork fat, we could use schmaltz or chicken fat, we could use lard if we wanted to, but we really want to have a pure fat that doesn't have extra liquid into it, because flour and liquid, now we're making bread, and that's a different episode. So we would cook this on the stove, clarified butter, and you'll see, and seriously, at home for the little bit that you're doing, this is one of those differences. Can you use whole butter? Of course you can. For the small amount that you're making, it's not going to make a big difference. And it's better to do it with whole butter for the small amount you need than not make it at all. I'd rather you do cooking and make an accommodation because you're not in a restaurant than to not cook because you're not in a restaurant. There are three basic stages to a roux, and they call them, they identify them by name. There's white, blonde, and brown. And then outside of this, we would have gumbo. That's also another episode. So 4 ounces, 1 stick of butter, and a cup of flour. Melt the butter into a pan. Once the butter's melted, add the flour, stir that together, and let that cook for about a minute, and that's a white roux. That's what we're going to use for thickening our regular chicken stock or our fish stock or even a white veal stock. And we would make that instead of roasting the bones, we would blanch the bones. But that's a tremendous amount of work, and I don't recommend you doing it at home just because it's crazy. And there's no need to do it. A blonde roux, we're going to cook for a couple of minutes on low heat. We want slower heat for cooking a roux than higher heat, because once it starts to go a little bit of a color, it goes kind of quickly, and it also has kind of like the heat of napalm. It will really, really burn, and it carries its own heat with it. So when you take it off of the stove, it's going to continue to brown a wee bit more. So slow is good. So a blonde roux would be used for thickening a roasted chicken stock. And we're going to make that brown roux to thicken our brown veal stock for our espagnol. It's going to take a little bit longer. It's possible to do it in the oven, but really, really, really got to watch it, because once it's burned, then it's garbage and there's just no recovering from that. Dan, let's take a minute out for a word from one of our affiliates. Folks, when you're making your stocks or your soups or whatever you've got going on the stove, you're going to need flavor. Flavor comes in herbs and spices, and I have no better source than Savory Spice. There's a picture on the blog of all of my collections, of their spice collections, and I'm telling you, they're fantastic. Click over to culinarylibertarian.com/savoryspice to check out their vast selection, not just the combinations, but also plenty of dried herbs and spices. culinarylibertarian.com/savoryspice. Now let's get back into the show. Thanks, Dan. All right, so we have our roux. The other thing that's important to know about the roux is the more we brown it, the less thickening power it has. Now, there's sort of a basic ratio, which I don't necessarily agree with, but I'm going to give it to you and tell you my caveat. So the ratio is 2 tablespoons of roux will thicken a cup of liquid. Well, yeah, and how? So I would suggest either backing off on the quantity of roux or upping your liquid content to make that liquid the sauce consistency you want. You've heard, possibly if you watch the TV shows, the sauce demi-glaze. Demi-glaze is worth making, but it's a labor of love. It may take a day or two, and it becomes very, very good, but it takes a lot of time. So you're going to start with, you're making an espagnol. And once you do that, you reduce that finished sauce by about a third. And then you're going to add veal stock back to the reduced espagnol sauce to bring it back to its original consistency. And what that gives you is a really incredibly deeply flavored sauce that is the perfect accompaniment to tornadoes or to a tenderloin filet or anything really grilled in New York, Porterhouse, Delmonico. They're very, very good. So the basics for all of these sauces are from Auguste Escoffier. Quite frankly, La Guide Culinaire is a spectacular resource, but if you aren't familiar with how it's laid out, it can be more confusing than helpful. So I'm going to put on the show notes page a link also to a cookbook by a recently passed chef named Paul Bocuse. And in his earlier years, he wrote a book called Paul Bocuse's French Cooking. And he has easier to accomplish recipes for the 5 mother sauces, which if you're going to do them, it's at least worth having a resource. We've made our roux, and we're going to use a white one, and we've made it, so we've cooled it. We've mixed it on the stove, we've cooked it for a couple of minutes, it didn't get any color, and I'm going to take it off, because it's pretty hot. One of the important considerations for thickening a liquid, be it milk or a stock, is we want one of those things to be hotter than the other relatively. So the roux doesn't necessarily need to be 40 degrees out of the refrigerator, if the liquid is boiling at sea level is 212 degrees, if our roux is at room temperature, that is a sufficient difference to prevent getting granny lumps. Now, we love granny and granny loved us, but sometimes granny's turkey gravy was a bit on the chewy side. Well, we can fix that. So what we're going to do is our liquid is boiling. We have our white chicken stock is on the stove and it's nearly a boil. So for every cup we have, let's say we have 4 cups, we're going to use, because I know what's going to happen, let's use 6 tablespoons of roux. Put those 6 tablespoons of roux into a small bowl and with a ladle 2 or 4 ounces of the hot broth onto that roux, don't burn yourself, and whisk that together to form a thick paste. And as you're whisking it, you're going to see that the heat from the stock is loosening the butter and flour roux mixture and making a thick, gooey paste. As you're making this thick, gooey paste, the strength of that goo is pulling apart any lumps that might happen. Once you put the roux into the hot liquid, you're kind of sealing the lumps because the science of what's happening with the flour and the protein of the flour hitting the hot liquid and coagulating, it makes this force field so that the little bits of flour that are on the inside can't get on the outside. Now, it's possible to strain your sauce or strain your soup, but we can save a step by not putting the lumps in the first place. So the bowl, the roux, the hot liquid, whisking to get out the lumps, add another ladleful just to make sure. And we've got all of that nice and whisked and smooth. Then that whole bowl contents, rub a spatula that into the pan of the hot liquid, give it a whisk so that everybody gets mixed around nice, bring that to a boil, and then cut that to a simmer. We want to get high heat on our roux thickened sauce for the complete activation of the starch. Roux will start to thicken immediately, but you won't see the final result until about 20 minutes later because the starch is going to take that much time to absorb the liquid that it's in and to do all of the little starchy things that's going on. So give it a good long while. And the thing, nothing horrible happens, but a roux thickened sauce, which hasn't been cooked sufficiently, has a pasty taste. You can sort of taste the raw flour. If you let it cook long enough, and so how you build your taste buds is taste it at the various stages along and sort of notice how as it cooks longer, that pastiness goes away. After 20 minutes or 30 minutes, that pastiness should be entirely eliminated. And what you end up seeing is you start to get a really deep shine in your sauce. Now, the other thing that's happening, and the reason that I went with less roux than the original ratio of 2 tablespoons to a cup is, as that is cooking, it's also reducing, which means that 4 cups isn't going to be 4 cups because water is coming out of it. As the water is coming out of it, the ratio of liquid to roux gets closer to what the original one was, and that's why I add more liquid than the ratio says, because I know I have heat and time, which are two very important ingredients that aren't on the recipe, but that's the thing that's making the difference here. So heat and time are the two best friends we have to make this really spectacular sauce. As the roux is cooking, because flour is an impure thing, it's got starch, it's got protein, it's got stuff, it's going to make a little bit more of that scummy stuff on top. Well, with a little soup spoon or something, pull that off as your sauce is boiling, as your sauce is reducing. Skim that stuff off and just put that on something that's discarded. There's nothing there. Now you've got this very nice sauce bechamel, which, by the way, a sauce bechamel is going to get classically the addition of what's called an onion pique. Some onion, a bay leaf, and a clove goes into the milk as you're warming the milk to be thickened with the roux. I want to let you know, be very cautious with milk on the stove. Use a higher sided pan than you think you need. Dairy, be it half and half or milk or cream, has enzymes inside, which when you boil it, it just makes foam, which goes all over the stove unless you're right there to watch it. Once it comes to the boil and the enzymes are deactivated, then that foaming problem goes away. It's only mildly irritating with milk. It's incredibly messy with a heavy cream because it just goes everywhere. And then you have the additional problem of all that fat possibly being a fire hazard. So higher edge pans and don't leave the stove. Once you have finished your cooking and the roux has cooked out, now technically your sauce is done. So we have this velouté, we have our espagnol, we have our bechamel. Now, how do we take this thing and make it into a small sauce? How do we make a derivative out of it? Well, some of them are pretty easy. Add a bunch of grated Gruyere cheese and you've got a sauce Mornay. Sauce soubise, a word on nomenclature. Escoffier was very fond of naming a lot of the dishes after people either contemporary in French history or in the past in French history, and soubise is one of those things. I think it's a French general. Soubise is lots of onions that are not allowed to caramelize, but they offer, through the course of cooking, a lot of their sweetness, and it's actually kind of a fun sauce to make. And it's a really tasty sauce to eat. So cheese sauce would be, so you make your bechamel, add your cheese sauce. Now you've got the base for macaroni and cheese. That's really how simple that is. So a mushroom sauce or any other aromatic. So we call our vegetables, the mirepoix is our aromatics. If we're going to add them to our sauce, there's a couple of ways to do this. You can add them in the beginning. When we add aromatics to our sauce, if we want to saute them to help pull out some of the flavors, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with doing that. We're going to put them into the liquid before it is thickened with the roux, so that as those two things are cooking together, the roux and the veggies and the stock, as those three things are cooking, we're letting the flavor come out into the sauce of whatever the thing is going to be, the garnish. So mushrooms would be that case. Mushrooms would be something I would saute the mushrooms ahead of time in a separate pan because they have a lot of water in them. There isn't any reason to add raw mushrooms to a sauce only to have them release all of the liquid and then thin their sauce out. So saute them ahead of time, concentrate their flavors. And if you look through really just any kind of a cookbook and sort of get an idea of the flavor you want for your sauce to complement the thing you're having for dinner, depending on the moisture level of the thing, and this is where it gets tricky on a podcast to talk about how to cook all the sauces there are. Sauteing brings out the flavor, reduces the liquid, and then I would put whatever that is into the liquid part of the sauce. And as it cooks, it gets the flavor. And of course, sauces are always going to be strained so that they're smooth. A mustard sauce, for example, I would saute some mustard seeds and put them in the beginning of the reduction, but also at the end, finish the sauce with just a little bit of fresh whole grain mustard. So you get a depth of flavor and then that real kind of a nice bump of mustard in the finished sauce. You can finish sauces with wines and just a little, like a couple of teaspoons of fresh Madeira or port or a good red wine. Red wine reductions are going to have to wait for another show, but there's a way to utilize those in making more kinds of brown sauces. The Hollandaise sauce is named after Holland, the Netherlands, is probably one of the most difficult sauces to make. And even if I don't recommend trying to follow the recipe procedure in Escoffier's book, because it is exceptionally difficult, even for seasoned cooks. It's hard. There are better ways to do it. I am not a particular fan of the blender versions, which seem to proliferate YouTube channels. I'm not a fan of that. If that's what you want to do, that's fine. I'm a fan of doing the Hollandaise sauce the classic way. So with a small caveat, again, going off of the classic Escoffier version to the more modern version, what we're making with a Hollandaise sauce is an emulsion. An emulsion is simply mixing together two things that don't normally mix. In this case, butterfat and water, or liquid and oil. So egg yolks are actually mostly fat, but they happen to have in them lecithin, which is a brilliant emulsifier. So we're going to add to 3 egg yolks, tablespoon of lemon juice and 2 tablespoons of water. And we're going to whisk those together over simmering water. So this is where I was like, what are you talking about? So you put your egg yolks and water and lemon juice in a bowl, metal bowl, and that's going to sit on top of the double boiler. And you're going to whisk that, and the steam from below is going to help cook the eggs, which we need for the finished sauce, the water and the lemon juice. The water is getting in the way of the fat to raise the coagulation temperature of the egg yolks, which normally would be 142-ish or something like that. Well, we're going to make it a higher temperature because we want that temperature to be higher so they are fully cooked. The lemon juice is doing the same thing as the water, but it's also adding flavor. So we're going to whisk that over the double boiler without stopping, because if we stop, the heat from the steam below will coagulate the eggs, making little bits of scrambled eggs, and scrambled eggs in hollandaise is just yuck. So whisk, 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 whisk. It's going to take 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, depending on how many egg yolks you're using, and we want to see something that's called ribboning, which means when you take the whisk out and let the egg yolk mixture drip off of it, it's going to make a trail on top of the egg yolks that you can see. It doesn't completely mix in. You sort of see where the trail was. Now you're done. Except I got ahead of myself because we're not even close to done. The very first step in doing a hollandaise isn't the eggs. It's clarifying the butter. So for those 3 egg yolks, we're going to probably 3/4 of a pound or 1 pound of butter, clarified. Butter, the best butter is going to be about 80% or so, maybe a little bit higher, of butterfat, which means 20% of that is stuff we're not going to use in the form of liquid, either in milk fats or milk solids, which ironically rise to the top, or in the form of whey, which will go to the bottom. So bring that to the boil so we can melt that. We want all the yellow stuff off, as much as you can get. Don't throw the rest of it away. We're going to use that for a later thing. But you want to get as much of that yellow off as you can and hold that sort of warm near your stove. The yellow butter isn't super hot because then it's going to break the sauce. Your butter's done. Now you whisk, whisk, whisk your egg yolks. They're ready to go. Take the bowl off of the top of the hot pot. Put it on top of a cool pot with either that shelf lining stuff so that the bowl doesn't spin around, because when you start whisking, you have centrifugal force and everything's going to spin in a circle. So the pot set on something that's going to hold it, and then the bowl set on top of the pot also with something in between the bowl and the pan that's going to hold it. And you're going to whisk your egg yolks at a medium speed and slowly drizzle, to begin with just a few drops at a time, the butter into the egg yolk mix. And slowly, slowly, slowly add that butter until it's all incorporated. Now, a couple of things can happen. The egg yolks can say, you know what? I ain't taking no more. Nothing you can do about it. Well, this feels like a moment of panic, but it's not. Take a little bit, like a little bit, a teaspoon of the hot water from the double boiler and add that to your egg yolk butter mix, and slowly, starting tight circles in the center, whisk that together until you start to see the whole thing coming back together. And it's possible it needs a second teaspoon of hot water. A broken hollandaise can be remedied. If the other thing that will happen is if your butter is still too hot of butter will cause the sauce to break. In this case, instead of hot water, you're going to add cold water. This is why hollandaise is so vexing, because there's so many ways it can go wrong. Depending on the way it went wrong, that depends on what the fix is. You've got all your butter incorporated, and now here's the thing. A properly made hollandaise ought not taste either of butter or egg, but a perfect balance of the two. Now, as a standard, that's a great thing to shoot for. As an expectation, well, you may miss. That's okay. The hollandaise gets finished with, if you prefer, a little bit of Tabasco or a little bit of cayenne, a little bit more lemon juice to brighten everything up. Check the salt level. And then I don't mind black pepper because it's my house. I don't care. But if you don't want to look like little ants at the party, white pepper is fine. And then hollandaise sauce doesn't really particularly like being held hanging around for somebody to come use it. So it's one of those things, make it and eat it quickly. Leftovers, kind of not so much good. There's a way to rescue the butter from that. It will have an eggy flavor, but that's okay for the omelets. But you can't really do anything with leftover hollandaise sauce. That's not so much a good idea. All right. So that was a crash course in mother sauces. Really, for ideas on how to use them, now, again, the bechamel and the velouté, they're relatively interchangeable. The main difference is that one is stock and one is milk, but you can pretty much do the same thing with either one of them. The velouté, so if you look at a clam chowder, aside from the characteristics of being bacon and potatoes, technically it's a velouté as the body of the soup. So the skill you've obtained for sauce making also will apply to your soup making. There's going to be some different processes going on for how you get the garnish inside, and then go back to culinarylibertarian.com/8 for some more on soup making. But with those basics and a decent book, and if you can get the Bocuse book, I would go with that. I don't have it, but there was a fellow, Patterson, I think, had a book on sauces, which was really pretty good. I remember that some students had that when I was teaching, and it was pretty good. Certainly good for the home cook. I had some qualms with it about the professional level, but he wasn't writing for the professionals. So find somebody you trust. Find somebody who you respect. I know he's loud, but aside from being obnoxious, Gordon Ramsay is a good cook, and his recipes work. So go out and give it a shot. Eggs Benedict is probably the most popular reason to make a hollandaise, but there's a fun twist to be had. Instead of using lemon juice, use orange juice for the beginning and at the end, and make the hollandaise, and then put that on asparagus. And I'm telling you, orange and egg and asparagus. Oh my goodness. It is just spectacular. Oh, you're going to love it. It's just amazing. It's worth doing. If you want to continue the discussion about mother sauces or small sauces, join the Culinary Libertarian Facebook group, and I'll be there, and we can discuss more about the particulars of mother sauce and small sauce making. All right, folks, that's going to do it. For your sauce making needs or basic kitchen needs, head over to culinarylibertarian.com/tools. That's one of my affiliate sites, and they've got, well, pretty much everything. But really what I'm thinking about is things like whisks and cutting boards and pans and, you know, kitchen spoons and ladles. Good stuff there, and that will help you with all of your cooking, including soup and sauce making. culinarylibertarian.com/tools. Have a great week. See you soon.